excess number 28776, real 6.
Admiral Sir Raymond Lygo, real 6. What happened at the end of the time when you'd been with the unit?
Well, after about 2 months, I suppose, I was appointed to 887, which was there were two seafire squadrons in what was then known as 24 Wing, an 887 and 894. And I went off to join 887, was then disembarked at Eglinton in Northern Ireland. So I had, first of all, to get across to Northern Ireland from Liverpool and was flown across there in an Oxford by one of the pilots in the FRU. And I've never forgotten that time. It was sitting, because there's hardly any room in the back of an Oxford with a bag and baggage. And he went at low level across the Irish Sea and literally almost collided with the Isle of Man. I mean, and the throttles opened up with a scream, and we proceeded to climb up the side of this hill and got over the top, fortunately, or we might have never made it. And then went into Northern Ireland and landed at Eglinton, and there I was. And I went to the wardroom, I suppose, and checked in there and said, well, where am I, or where should I go? And they said, we're at dispersal site, whatever it was. And so I was put in a tilly and sent off to this mud field in which there were numerous kind of mizzen huts, which were the officers' accommodation. And I was given a cabin number, and I found this cabin, and it was bitterly cold. There was nobody about, not a soul, not nobody. It was about 10 o'clock, I suppose, by the time I got there and had some supper in the water when I got there. I went to bed. And then about midnight, I heard a tremendous ruckus outside, and the squadron was returning from a run ashore in Londonderry. And as I lay there in some trepidation, I knew it would happen. Somebody said, I think we've got a new boy here somewhere. And I thought, oh, my God. And so I was dragged out in my pyjamas too, and there was the squadron. They'd just come back. They were all in uniform, mess undressed. And one New Zealander called Jimmy Sheeran, we got blood all over him. And I remember saying, what happened to him? And the chap said, he was trying to buy what do you call them, contraceptives in those days? What do we call them? Rubbers. No, it's an American expression. French letters. He was trying to buy a French letter in Londonderry. And, of course, and he went into a chemist's shop and said, I wasn't. And they said, we don't sell things like that. So he walked out through the plate glass window. Oh, Jesus, you know. I mean, what have I done? Where have I? And so I was finally allowed to go back to bed, and they all turned in drunk. And next morning, of course, they were all hungover. It was usual kind of Northern Ireland weather. It was clamped, and so I was trying to get somebody to check me out in the Seafire 3, because I'd not flown a Seafire 3, which is what the squadron had. Couldn't get any sense out of anybody. So finally I went out and sat in an aeroplane all by myself, because it had a new gun sight, a gyroscopic gun sight, which was supposed to be much better. And so, as I sat in the cockpit and got used to this new aeroplane and walked around it, but there was nobody about, and I went up to wardroom, which was another big mizzen hut, and as I walked, the bar was on the left, I've forgotten it, into the anteroom, and the fire was at the end. And I went up to read the Times, which I'd always been taught by my father to do. So I got up there and sat down and started reading the Times, and the chap I was relieving in the squadron came over and said, Ray, he said, the CO would like you to join us at the bar. And I said, oh, yes, certainly. So I got up and walked towards the bar, and there was this fellow, not a very nice man, called Wigington. And he was a CO, and he said, oh, Lygo, he said, don't worry, he said, we've been buying for you. And I thought, well, and I was about to say, well, I don't drink, sir. I'm sorry, I don't drink. And he said, well, nice to have you. He said, they sent us somebody else before you. He said, he only lasted 2 weeks. And in all my innocence, I said, why was that, sir? And he said, he didn't drink. So my hand went out for my first glass of Guinness. And Dick Reynolds, who became a good friend of mine, who was in the other squadron, who sat opposite me at lunch, said, well, you never showed it, Ray, but how you managed to hold it, all that stuff down without throwing up or whatever, I don't know, but you did. And that was my introduction to 887. And so there I was, and once again, you... And then the squadron was going off to do fighter sweeps over France. And they were going down to Ballykelly, I think, to do that. They must have been going down to southern England somewhere. Anyway, I was considered to be too sprog-like to do that, so I was left with 894 to carry on and do some basic flying. 894 was a much better squadron, much better organised at that time, nicer chaps in it. And so I was very happy there, and the 887 were away for about a month, I suppose, doing their fighter sweeps from wherever it was, and then they came back and I rejoined them and we embarked in Indefatigable.
Could I ask, what makes the difference between the squadrons? You said that one was better organised, but is there a reason for it?
Yes, the CA was a better chap, and they're a better bunch of characters, I think, and better organised. I thought they had some very nasty accidents, I'm bound to say, but thank God I was involved, but they were a better organised one. And the difference between, not at that time, we both were F3 squadrons. That is to say, we had an aeroplane called the CFR F3. So we embarked in Indefatigable and went up to do Russian convoys and various things like that.
With that, embarking on a carrier, it was a much larger carrier, wasn't
yes.
it? And it's your first experience of being on a carrier. Where are you accommodated on, and how is the squadron organised on a carrier?
Well, you had three sources of... with which you came familiar. Well, first, you were allocated a cabin. I was lucky to be allocated a berth in a cabin, because some of the midshipmen were sleeping in the corridors, in the passageways. So I had a accommodation, I can't remember where it was, probably four to a cabin or something. And so I was lucky enough to have a bunk in a cabin. And that was one thing you got used to. And this was right at the aft end of the ship, near the quarterdeck. And then the wardroom was midships, so you had quite a long walk along to get to the wardroom. And above the wardroom, and the anteroom, the wardroom is where you ate, and the anteroom was where you chatted and drank, if you drank. And then upstairs, as it were, up aloft, was the crew room, which was just off the flight deck. And those were the places with which you became most familiar. Those were the crew room, the wardroom, your cabin. And life revolved around those three places, really. And so that was that.
And am I right in thinking that the squadron is almost self-contained?
Yes, it was a self-contained unit. The CO was the man that was most important. There was a nice senior pilot who was a very nice chap, but not terribly effective. Andrew Thompson, who was very kind to me, but you see, I mean, what was I, 19, I suppose, 20, and he was, 24, considered to be terribly old, and and anyway, so, but yes, you worked as a squadron group, really. You had friends in some of the other squadrons that you'd known before or that you met there. One of mine was a fellow called Ken Ward, who got a DSO later on at, for shooting an aircraft off Sumatra. And, yes, I mean, it was a self-contained unit.
And does that include the ground crew as well?
No. It included the engineer officer. It didn't include the petty officer. You met the petty officer pilots in the crew room, but that's the only time you'd met them. They weren't accommodated in the wardroom. They didn't sleep down aft. They slept in petty officer accommodation, and can you believe it? I mean, and so there was a segregation between the crew, and you met the ground crew on deck in the hangar when you were working on your aeroplane, and you know, you made it a point to go and chat to them. You had usually an air fitter and to look after the airframe, and an air mechanic to look after the engine, and then the duties of radio and electrical and things like that were kind of centralised, and you didn't have one person for that. So that's how you made, you know, contact with them and related to them.
Is it important to form a good relationship with your ground crew?
Oh, yes, I think it's always a good, a most important part of it. But you see, we'd had no training as to how to do that. We were made divisional officers, some of us, because the squadron was divided into divisions, which is the naval divisional system, the air mechanics division, the electrical division, the various divisions. I can't remember the first job I had. Didn't amount to very much, I'm sure. But and that gave you familiarity with them, and made your relation with them was do the work you did with them, part of the naval system. And so that was the way we operated.
And did the ground crew stay with the squadron?
Yeah.
At all times, they're not part of the ship's crew.
No, they were no squadron maintenance. And many years later, we tried centralised maintenance. It was a disaster.
Why was that?
Morale suffered. People work best in football teams, and they don't like being in large amorphous masses where they're not responsible directly for what's going on. I like to feel responsible, and our ground crew felt totally responsible. I come back having fired my guns, and they could tell because the material, I've lost the word for it now, that had been pasted over the gun ports to make, you know, that would be shot away, of course, as you open fire with the guns. They'd know that, you know, you've done something, and they were very proud of that. Their aeroplane had actually done something.
And how were relations then with the carrier's crew, the naval crew?
Remote. They had very little to do with them at all. I had one particular friend I don't know how it came about, in Indefatigable, who was a warrant, because we had warrant officers in those days, a warrant electrician, and I remember he had me down because the warrant officer's mess was really more luxurious than the wardroom, because they were better organised, and we were overcrowded in the wardroom. And his name was Reg Poley, and we struck up a friendship, and that was my main contact with the with the ship's company, I suppose, really. He was the one I knew most about. But, you know, we knew Commander Air, and we knew the ops officer who was responsible for briefing us, and we knew about Little F, Lieutenant Commander Flying, and the flight deck officer, and people like that you would know. And the direction officers, of course, which directed us as fighter pilots, we knew the Ds. But and one of those became a lifelong friend of mine, who finished up as a full admiral, died sadly some years ago, and was a direction officer in Indefatigable.
And What's the kind of relation in at this period while you're on Indefatigable between the captain of the carrier, who's dealing with the day-to-day running of the ship, right, and the flying crews? Is there one, or is it?
Oh, there was very much a relationship, but it was a fairly distant one. I mean, poor man, he was a man called Q.D. Graham, who'd had a very gallant past, I believe, in the early part of the war, and was now captain of this great big carrier, the biggest one we had. But the Admiral was Vian, Admiral Vian, of some fame. And he was located in Indomitable. Now, at this stage in the operations, he wasn't around. We weren't under his direct command. When we got out to the Indian and Pacific Oceans, when he was around, but that was a later story. But at this stage, he wasn't. But there were various funny episodes, some not so funny, some quite sad and tragic. But I mean, one of the funny episodes was we were up flying off North Norway. And what we tried to do, and did, was to attack the German airfields in North Norway to keep the Messerschmitts and attack aircraft that would come out and attack the convoy, because we were protecting the convoys going off to Russia, and to keep the aeroplanes down, or to stir them up, or whatever you came out of it, and whatever you may conclude. But why did I start telling you that story? Gone now.
It was about the captain.
Oh, I know, and we ran out of tyres. As I told you, 60% of the landing I was taking, so you'd burst tyres, quite bang, you know, you'd be wheel forward and another tyre put on, or a wheel with a tyre on it put on. And the dreaded moment came when the air engineer officer of the ship had to go to tell the captain that we'd have to stop flying the Seafires because there were no more tyres. So dear old Q.D. Graham said, well, we can't stop flying because of that. And he said, well, I'm afraid we have to, sir. We have no tyres. He said, well, bind the wheels with rope. Now, that would have stuffed the helio straight up through the... You know, someone had to explain to him that that was a good seaman's gesture, but it really wouldn't do. And that was one reason we had to stop flying. Another reason we got stopped flying, and that was when I had an accident, but, I mean... I was flying towards the evening, and so I knew I'd be landing into the setting sun, so I knew there would be, so I put tinted lenses in my spectacles, in my goggles, so that I would be alright to see. And when it came time to land on, to our horror, the ship didn't recover us, but turned in an opposite direction and steamed off at high speed. And what happened is the submarine had torpedoed the Nabob, or the Trumpeter. There were two escort carriers with us. I can't remember which one. And all our carrier was doing was getting the hell out of the area where the submarine might be. So here were we running out of fuel, with the carrier screaming over the horizon, the sun setting, the blue flames coming out of the exhaust, and LIGO with tinted lenses in his glasses. I mean... It was a recipe for total bloody disaster. And I was flying number two to the CO at that time, who by this time was Andrew Thompson, who had been the senior pilot. And he we weren't allowed to use RT, said it was this sign of drinking, indicated we're getting low on fuel. And of course we were all getting low on fuel. So, in the end, the commander said, sir, to the captain, we'll have to turn into wind and get these Seafires back, or they're all going to go into the sea because they're going to run out of fuel. So, he reluctantly agreed to turn into wind, because it was a dangerous thing for him to do. So, here's the ship turning, and Andrew Thompson of Syria was the first to go in, and of course he got nowhere near the ship because it was still turning. I was number two, and the ship was still turning. I couldn't understand why I was having such difficulty lining up. And apparently, although I didn't know it, the ship was still turning. And the commander said to the batsman, all right, bring him on, even though the ship was still turning. And of course, they brought me on, and I was drifting as I landed and broke an undercarriage, collapsed undercarriage. So that was a great help to everybody, because I had to be towed for a jackpot and towed for. They were very quick at doing things in those days, and got clear. But I had broken an undercarriage, but that was purely because, you know, the ship was under helm. So we all got back, or all of us got back, but I shall not forget that in a hurry. The answer was always have a spare pair of goggles, because I was then trying to change my lenses in the, and there was no way you could do it. One hand on the stick, one, I mean, it was a waste of time. But anyway, that was one of the more exciting episodes.
It's interesting though, because obviously the relationship with the captain, his main thing on the ship then is really to the protection of the carrier, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
Rather
that's
than
right.
the protection of the pilots who are
oh, that's
back
right.
to it.
Well, that was very much evident in the Battle of Midway, of course, when the Admiral launched all the aircraft out of range. But he won the Battle of Midway. As a result, they found the got the Japanese with their trousers down. But many of them didn't get back.
When you were doing these Arctic patrols, what would the duration of them be on the carrier?
Well, this was one of the troubles with the Seafire, of course. But even with long-range tanks, you had an hour and a half endurance. And so, you know, you weren't up for very long. And it's interesting to recall how we... We had 30 or 45-gallon long-range tanks, which were undercarriage, which were belly tanks. And when you started the engine on deck, you then switched on the... I can't remember what it was now, the tank switch here. Turned on the tank fuel, switched off the main tank, your main fuel. If the engine kept running, then you were drawing fuel from the belly tank. If the engine stopped, you weren't. So you were drawing fuel. Okay, fine. Yes, all right. Which I know, sweetie. And so that's where you check the tank. Then when you got airborne on your main tanks, as soon as you got airborne, you switched on your belly tank, switched off your main tank, and off you went. And you ran until the engine stopped. And when the engine stopped, boom, you knew you'd run out of fuel on your belly tank. So then you switched on your main tank, the engine started again. And that's how we did it. I mean, and this was all done at low level, 50 feet. And when you think about it today, you think, I mean, but that, it was that rudimentary. But that's the way we did it. And so you'd be flying in formation four, suddenly this chap would go disappear backwards because his engine just stopped, and then he'd come blowing up again and join. And then this chap would, and the most of them would run out at about the same time. And that's how you use all the fuel in your tank.
The first time that happens, I imagine it's slightly unnerving, isn't it?
No, well, it's amazing because that's the way you, you were told that's the way it happened. You didn't pay attention to it. The engine picked up again immediately. You turned the main tank on. So it was there was no problem. But that's the way you did it. And, of course, they were in short supply. So these were supposed to be jettison tanks, but you didn't jettison because... You jettisoned them, and there weren't any more to replace them. So you kept them. That was there. They were full of gasoline fumes, I imagine. And if you were hit, they would not be very helpful.
Could that be a problem if you were making a carrier, a landing on the deck?
No, not at all. No, they were fine. The airplane was designed to fly with them on, so there wasn't any problem. None at all. The problem was. Not with the Seafire in those days, with other aircraft coming back with bombs which they couldn't get rid of. And then you'd land in rockets. And I've seen many, particularly Fireflies and Avengers, because we got rid of the Barracudas by the time we were in the Pacific. And they'd catch a wire, and that would arrest the airplane, and the bomb would go floating off down the deck, you know. Or the rocket would go shooting off down the deck. Very interesting, yeah. Very exciting.
And the patrols, would you be flying a combat air patrol around the convoy?
Normally, we, over the fleet as a whole, and my luck, or bad luck, whichever way you like to look at it, was always to be in a high-level aircraft. In other words, one designed to combat at height. So we would immediately be climbed up to 20,000-30,000 feet, we'd be on oxygen, to do fighter patrols over the fleet in case the fleet was attacked. We never were attacked at that altitude. I mean, it was one of my more amusing lines. We were denying the use of the air to the enemy, but he didn't want it. When we got out to the Far East, in the Indian Ocean, 894 had been equipped with called L-3s, low-level 3s. And these were aircraft, CFARs, designed specifically to operate at low level. So they used to do what was known as a box patrol. And you put a square box around the fleet, two airplanes, and they'd merely fly up and down like this, looking always away from the fleet to see if aircraft were coming in or if the air if the air directors could find aircraft approaching the fleet, and then they would tell them to turn around. So those were the chaps that got all the fun down there. Up at altitude, we were statelily wandering around the sky, denying the enemy's use of a piece of the air they didn't want to use anyway.
What was the main threat perceived to be in the Arctic? Was it German bombers or torpedo bombers? Or
most of the threats that we foresaw up in North Norway would have come for long-range Messerschmitts and things like that would have come out. It would have been a bit difficult for them attacking the fleet, come to think of it. But that is possible. We're also often shadowed by shadowing aircraft, Blommenboss's great big seaplanes, which several of my colleagues were lucky enough to be airborne when they were around, and then they were easily shot down. But I mean, that, you know, it was all the luck of the draw. But we weren't in those convoys. We were never attacked. We attacked them, their air bases. On the ground, strafe them, strafe them, attack. I mean, the Germans used to supply columns to North Norway, came up through the leads, as they were called, inside Norway. And by day they would stop and moor right up against the side of a cliff or a mountain, which was very difficult for you to attack because there was a ship right alongside you. Grave danger of going straight into the really cliff. But so one was strafe these, because that's all we had is our guns, and generally attempt to muck up their supply routes, and strafe the airfields from which the Messerschmitts would come, hoping to catch them on the ground, which we usually did, and then disappear, hightail it out of there before they could get up and chase after us. And that was our main occupation. In attacking those airfields and shipping in the leads.
When strafing either a ship or an airfield, are there any kind of survival rules that you impose on an attack? Would you make one pass or would you make multiple passes or that sort of thing?
No, it's a good kind of survival technique that you don't do more than one pass. in any case, we were like, if it was the airfield, we go across one, off, and then if we had any ammunition left, down the leads, looking for aircraft alongside, in towns and places like Narvik and place Tromsø and places like that, and ships that were then, as I say, moored up and attacking those. Of course, the trouble was, and this was difficult to avoid, you were bound to be inflicting casualties on the Norwegian population. Rather than the Germans at times, but I mean, there was no way that you could distinguish between the two of them, sadly. And I think it's great credit to the Norwegians that they appear, and subsequent information after the war, they understood perfectly, I mean, that that's what we had to do.